Hey everybody, welcome to Stuff Said, the show where I, Greg Schiegel, cartoonist, talk to people in the worlds of comics, cartooning, and beyond. This episode is the third and final installment in the summer series, summer concert series, that I've been calling it, of panel recordings from the Emerald City Comic Con back in April of 2014. This panel is called Comics Aren't Real, and I'm going to get to more of that in a second. First, I'm going to put the business up front, or some of the business up front. In the beginning of September, September 5th, 6th, and 7th, I will be at Baltimore Comic Con as part of their Kids Love Comics Pavilion with a great group of comic makers. I'm excited to be part of that group. I will be debuting my graphic novel, Pix One Weirdest Weekend. You can read the first chapter for free right now at pixcomic.com, so check that out. But if you're going to be at Baltimore or near Baltimore, stop by. I'm going to have this book. You'll see what I do if you haven't been reading SpongeBob comics or other things I do. Also at Baltimore Comic Con, they give out the Harvey Awards. And I'd be remiss to not mention that frequent guest on this show, friend of the show Chris Giarrusso, is nominated for one of those Harvey Awards. So if you are a professional person able to vote, consider a vote in that direction. And I'll put links of all this stuff on the website, stuffsaidshow.com, where you can donate to support this show with dollars. More on that after the panel. So I want to talk about this panel real quick. This recording, unlike the last two you heard, was done in the room, which is to say it wasn't recorded via soundboard, or it wasn't recorded for flipon.tv. It wasn't simulcast. It wasn't recorded at all, so I was recording it with what I had on me. In this instance, it was my iPad. It's not the greatest audio fidelity, but it is not terrible. It is quite listenable. I've listened to it several times. Every now and again, you get some noise from the adjoining room, where apparently something uproarious and amazing was happening, because there was laughs and applause. It gets a little annoying, but you can still hear us talking, and that's what's important. I promise you, this is a great 50 minutes or so of chatter with awesome guests. I had Rob Guillory, Eric Larson in what is now his second appearance on this show, Kazu Kibuishi, and Klaus Janson. And that's a panel I am super proud to have put together. I think it really represents a diverse cross-section of comics, from veterans to newer creators, work for hire and creator-owned, the direct market and the book market, grown-up comics, all-ages comics, kids' comics. And while I thought, hey, worst case scenario, I'm confident that Eric and I can fill an hour. And if you follow Eric Larson on Twitter, you'll hear some of what he says here, mirroring some of the things he says on Twitter. But I'm happy to say that that was not the case at all. Everybody participated. It was great. Everybody had excellent things to say. It's one of those, it's a conversation that I wish we could have done longer. But we had 50 minutes, and we filled those 50 minutes, and I'm going to let you hear those 50 minutes now.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality.
Hello?
Yes, baby, it's really great to be here. I'm going to say right now, this is going to be the best. And you guys are the lucky few that get to be here, because this is going to be the best panel. Just look at this lineup. Just process what's about to happen here. As I embarrass my guests.
Oh, thanks. That's all right.
Everyone on this panel is drunk.
Drunk on comics.
Drunk on tiredness.
Well, that and gin. I mean, yeah. It's a spicy cocktail.
So the name of this panel is Comics Aren't Real. And the idea of it is to... It wasn't that funny. The idea of it is to talk about the things in comics that are not realistic. Because the trend, it feels like the trend in comics, is for things to be more and more quote-unquote realistic. And I say quote-unquote realistic because the fact of the matter is Batman is neither realistic nor relatable in any way. He's a billionaire who's the greatest human in the world. And that's none of those. And how many people have really seen their parents get murdered in front of their eyes? It doesn't happen.
Jeff, I think about this a lot.
Of course. Let's start.
I think about this a lot. I don't really relate a lot to DC Comics characters, but I do relate to Marvel Comics characters. And I think it's because, like you just said, like they're not really relatable.
Yep.
And I think, like Superman, I can't really relate to. I can relate more to Batman, because he is human.
Human-ish.
I think that you could make them a lot more human if you had one, with one scene, really. I think if you put Superman in an instance where he has to fix his toilet, like give him some human problems.
He would use super toilet breath.
Maybe he would. But that would like make them instantly more.
You see how he's wanting to make it more realistic?
I know.
Immediately.
So that's
where the premise is.
You've now seen the premise in action.
This is like everybody in comics going, I know what this needs.
See, the thing is, I totally disagree with. Oh, go ahead.
What?
This is the best.
Not with you.
Ever.
I totally disagree with the fact that they're not relatable, because I think
they're
incredibly relatable.
Going with relatable. I don't have any problem with relatable.
But I understand. But people talk about Batman specifically as being.
He's so
relatable. He's human.
Oh my gosh,
and he's a regular guy, and he trained himself.
Right.
No, it's
he works. Yeah.
People are like, you know, that guy who flies through the air and isn't on fire. That guy, I totally believe. But Wonder Woman running in heels? What the hell? That's impossible.
Right. Absolutely. So we are going to celebrate the things that are not realistic.
Cannot happen.
We're going to celebrate costumes where you can't see the seams, mm-hmm. where they just look like they're painted on. We're going to talk about thought balloons and weird panel shapes and all the stuff that make comics awesome that are not realistic. And that's why I've assembled this murderer's row of talent. Because they are all responsible for comics that aren't realistic in various different ways. So I'm going to start from the far end with Klaus Janson, who has worked on so many comics I don't know where to even start the list. But Klaus's ink line is legendary, and it is... it's art.
What's the first one? What is like the first comic where you're like, I totally inked this entirely myself, not just some background deal? Because I know you did that.
It was Black Panther over Rich Buckler.
Black Panther over Rich Buckler.
But that's you worked on The Dark Knight Returns. You worked on Daredevil.
Yeah, but that was way later.
But I'm saying,
you inked John Romita Jr. on a great run of Thor that I was the editor on, which was high mark of unrealistic comics.
Oh, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, they're
that
fun.
Was, we
exactly.
had, yeah, John and I both had a lot of fun. Yeah.
But Klaus,
I inked Eric on Thor.
He did.
Which was tremendous fun.
That was big fun for me.
And it's, but your artwork and your when you draw and when you ink, you're not trying to create a realistic image. You're creating an artistic image, an interpretation of reality through an artistic, and your color theory and all that is
right.
You're not recreating reality. You're making comics.
Right.
And you also teach comics at School of Visual Arts, and that's going to come in handy in this very scholarly discussion. next to Klaus is Kazuki Buishi, who you may know from the Amulet series of books and the Flight anthologies.
Did you pronounce that at all right?
Yeah.
just curious.
I actually don't care.
Which are books full of imagination, talking animals, talking robots, fantastic places. Things that are not realistic, although the work Kazu does is emotionally grounded and relatable, which we're going to talk about as part of this conversation.
Yeah, actually, I used to always tell people, yeah, the only thing that's truly real in my books is the emotions and like the emotional content and the ideas under the surface, all the subtext. Everything I do as a writer, it actually is. Even the adventure in Amulet is a lot of the feelings that come through in the book, they're based on things that happened to me in my life.
The first 10 pages, I think, of Amulet Book 1 are intense. If you've never read it, just read the first 10 pages and you're locked in. Like, I need to know what happens to this little girl.
Yeah, I was almost going to take that out of the book because I thought it was too intense for kids. To Scholastic's credit, they said, no, you know, you can't start this book without that now. Like,
yeah,
now that
great.
We've seen it, you have to have it in there. And so it's a pretty jarring sequence. And I figured also it's like kind of a ride height requirement for a book. So then if the kids can't handle it within 10 pages, you might want to stop at that point.
Sure.
But most of the time the kids are enthralled. I mean, they see it and I think they relate to it because it actually was based on something that happened to to my family when I was about 8 years old.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
But I mean, my dad didn't die. My real father didn't.
Can we spoil the first 10 pages?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I mean, it's different than actually experiencing it.
No, it's a family driving home to pick up, or driving to pick up one of the kids, and there was a car accident. And the daughter and mother see their father die before them. The car falls off a cliff.
Yeah, you watch him die.
They watch him die. And it's intense.
Yeah, and well, one of the things is I was drawing comics for kids, but I wanted to make sure that people knew I felt all ages meant all ages. This is going to be for everybody. And I always, whenever there's something dark that happens in my comics, I make sure that I present it with a guiding hand. So when you read it, it doesn't feel violent. It is violent when you actually see it. There's blood, there's like metal shrapnel everywhere, there's snow flying everywhere, and you know, and then people crying. And it's you know, it's like emotionally violent, but it does always feel like somebody's helping you through it. And that's really, I think, what a lot of the kids who are reading Amulet, they're kind of going through a lot of that the emotional confusion of, you know, whether like they're their own person when they're 8 or 10 years old, and if they lost their mom or dad, what would happen? That's always like this is people wonder why like there's a death of a parent in the beginning of so many Disney films.
Yeah.
Well, it's because the ritual of watching that movie is one where these kids are working through the process of figuring out if they can live without their parents. That's like, because it's like their job is to be their parent's son or daughter.
Sure.
So it would be like them losing their job.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, can I survive, you know? Because I went through it myself, I knew that I was thinking about those things. I just didn't talk to anybody about it. So I felt it was important that I tried to empathize with my audience, and my audience was 8 to 12 years old. They're thinking about their parents' death.
Yeah, so everybody go read Amulet. That's the hard plug. Next to Kazu is Eric Larson, who is the impresario of the Savage Dragon for 20-plus years, 22 years. Writing, drawing, inking a series that is far from realistic.
What?
I'll try and embarrass Eric now and say he is doing modern Jack Kirby. He's blowing it out of the water and making bold, ballsy superhero comics, which not a lot of people do that much anymore. So that's Eric Larson. You want to say anything about that?
No, I've seen nothing about that.
Great. And next to Eric is Roth Guillory, who illustrates the comic book Chew, which, if you're not reading that, is another book that takes place in a world where chicken has been banned, and the artwork is fantastic and funky and dynamic in its design sense and proportions, but it is all within its world. Everything fits and makes sense. And Rob does backgrounds that are incredibly intricate with references and little bits of text in the back, and it, again, not realistic, that you can sit and stop and read these backgrounds and sort of go deeper into this story because it's comics, and you can do that in comics. You can't really do that in a movie. You can't do that in other media. So this is the all-star panel. I am Greg Siegel. I draw SpongeBob comics, which are also not realistic, and I host a podcast called Stuff Said at StuffSaidShow.com, which I encourage everybody to listen to. Rob has been, Eric has been on it. Klaus will be on it one of these days. The rest of the guys all be on it. I'll talk to everybody. So, I want to start talking about comics not being realistic by talking about art. Everybody on this panel draws, creates art, and the tendency seems to be in modern comics, mainstream comics, for photorealistic renderings of art, realistic backgrounds, places looking like places, and you guys don't do that exactly. You create environments that are real within the context of your worlds. And I kind of want to talk about that. Drawing a world that is true to itself, but maybe not true to the real world. Who wants to start?
Well, I think the key term is believability. So whatever you can do to make whatever it is you're creating, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, believable is kind of what you want to go with. Even if it's abstract, there's something about it.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
That was much more succinct than what I said.
Yeah. I mean, with Chu, we kind of went through this when the initial pitch was kind of put out there, like announced. like there were people that were saying like, oh, that's ridiculous. like the other part of the pitch is there's a guy who gets psychic visions from what he eats. So if he eats like an apple or if he eats a hamburger, he'll see like the entire life of the cow to the death. And he uses this to solve crimes. So he has to end up eating really horrible things. And there were people that were just like, ah, it's ridiculous. Like, this is comics. Like, comics is all about unreality. I mean, like, you look at, like, a guy like Wolverine, it's like a Canadian midget who's hairy, who has knives that come out of his hands.
And it's been
like,
alive forever.
Right, and yeah. He's, like, the biggest guy in comics. I mean, comics is all about accepting a reality, and once you do accept that reality, like you said, believability of the world, once you accept that, it's all fair game. Like, the second people understood, like, you know, there's this comic called Chew that's all about food, people having food-related powers. It's a food-related world. And the second people understood that and accepted it, it just went nuts. I mean, in the beginning, it's more police procedural, but by issue 8, we introduced a character called Pollo.
Pollo is great.
Pollo is a cockfighting rooster who wears a luchador mask and is the baddest. He's the biggest badass on the planet. And as it goes along, he gets like cybernetic enhancements. It just goes way over the top. He's like ripping people's hearts out, and like it's the chicken. But we've created a world where we can do that because this is comics and this is what Chew does, and people have totally gone with it.
Nice,
Klaus.
What?
You've worked on some comics that people have pointed to as being gritty and realist, you know, Frank Miller's Daredevil, certainly, or The Dark Knight Returns, which people look to content-wise as being these super hyper-realistic, and this is what it would be like if Batman was 50 years old. But if you really read it, it's not. But the artwork, certainly, in those books is not real.
No.
When you were doing those things, and when you're approaching a comic in general, inking it or drawing it or writing it, because you have written comics, there's a very cool issue of What If that plays with the reality of
the comics world
and what is real.
Yeah.
When you're approaching comics, and you also teach comics, what is your sort of baseline philosophy in terms of how you're coming to this stuff? Is it the same idea of creating this believable world? And
I think that what everybody is saying is absolutely true, that there has to be a certain amount of believability in the world that you're creating. The word that I use is credibility. It's the, you know, two cents difference between credibility and believability. But once you create a world that's convincing and stays within its established boundaries, you're really good to go. The problem that I have with reality-based art I consider myself a cartoonist. That's what I put down, you know, on my income tax.
Same here, man.
I think we all do that, right? Cartoonists, all five?
I'm not a Xerox machine. I'm not a, I'm not a photographer. I'm not, I stay away from mimicking reality. I can, you know, kind of replicate it and I kind of play with it, but I'm not interested in mimicking reality and reproducing reality because it's boring. I see reality every day. You know, I see too much of it, frankly. I want to see something, I want to see a version of life and the world that's channeled through someone's point of view. And I hope that that's, you know, what I'm trying to do, you know. And I think one of the things that people are fascinated by is the notion that inking could be emotional or has the ability to communicate emotion just in a line. And I'm fascinated by that, you know. I don't particularly believe that that's reality. I think that is, I don't know what to call it. I think it's almost hyper-reality, you know. I think cartooning is much more effective in getting to the reader than mimicking or reproducing reality as we see it. I'm not interested.
Yeah, I certainly think with what you do, with the way you play with lines and lights and shadows and things, you are communicating emotions and ideas much more, you know, it's words over, it's pictures
that's,
over words, picture worth
right.
a thousand words. So you
right.
can create a sense with a line of anxiety or calm that's certainly not, you know, a line creating an emotion is another level of, it's not reality, it is art, right?
You know, I got into trouble one time. I did an interview a long, long time ago and during the Daredevil days. And in the middle of the interview, I said something about how I had inked a table and made the table sad. You know, and I think I was, you know, it was a little hyperbole, a little exaggeration. But that is actually kind of the goal. That's fun, to be able to draw a table and make that table sad. You know, I'm interested in that. That's, you know, I'm not interested in being a what would you say, a photographer of reality.
Yeah.
I'm just not interested in that.
Yeah. On this subject, I always when people, you know, ask me why do you draw cartoons? Because my main characters are very simple. They're like almost happy faces that kind of travel through these super ornate lands, you know, and because when I normally, if I paint an illustration, I sat down and did an illustration, people look at it and they're like, this is like kind of realistic, because when I did the Harry Potter covers, that's the style, it's a totally different style than the way that the characters are drawn in Amulet. But I always point people back to understanding comics by Scott McCloud, and he actually pretty much nailed it, this idea of going back to relatability. When you see a more rendered face, you think of someone as the other, and you see one that's simplified, and you start thinking of them as yourself, because the faces, just their emotions are clear, but their who they are isn't as clear. So you just apply yourself to it. So you see a happy face, and you think of yourself in it. But if you see like somebody's rendered face, then you think that's just that other person, and so you don't enter into the world. So I always thought of my cartoons as vessels for entering into this semi-realistic fantasy, like in Amulet. So all my characters have these dumpling-like, you know, simple faces, because it gets the emotion across very quickly, and you feel like you're there. And then you see these very rendered paintings and vistas.
Yeah, your backgrounds are very lush. It's almost like Tintin, where the...
Right, or more like animation, like Miyazaki's films or Disney films. They use the same principle, where the backgrounds are very ornate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to that point, to the point of characters being simplified and iconic, you know, you look at something like the Ultimates that Marvel Comics puts out, and Nick Fury is drawn to look like Samuel L. Jackson, and that creates a very specific... thing. Like, it's trying so hard to be a real thing that it I don't know, bothers me.
Well, I think, if I may say, I mean, for me, listen, I'm a big fan of Brian Hitch. And
sure,
what he
he's
does,
terrific.
You know, what he does is quite an accomplishment. It's really amazing. And The Ultimates was just amazing in terms of what he was able to accomplish. But it took me out of the story.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm not sure that was a good thing.
Right.
You know, I wanted to mention just you're talking about.
Miles, you can mention anything you want.
Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
You know, one of the things I wanted to mention, just, you know, talking about cartooning and creating a reality. You know, we live in a three-dimensional world, and we take it for granted. I mean, we all take it for granted. This is something that, you know, art students are kind of amazed at. We wake, you know, the very first thing we see is, you know, three dimensions, height, width, and depth. But Charles Schulz never drew three dimensions in his life. The Peanuts is completely flat. You'll never see Snoopy's doghouse from an angle. It's always flat. And yet we completely buy Peanuts. You know, nobody ever says, oh, you know, this isn't real. This isn't three-dimensional. There's something wrong with this. You know, it was through his talent and through his abilities that we completely enter that world and accept it.
Well, he had some problems with the animation, because they wanted to be able to turn some of this stuff, and they realized his characters' arms are so short that if you turn them, Linus's thumb couldn't possibly reach his mouth, because it's just, and once you turn Snoopy's doghouse, you realize, oh, it comes to a pitch there's no place for him to actually lie
right.
down.
That's right.
It doesn't work.
Have you guys done turnarounds of your own characters? I've tried. Yeah. No. It doesn't work. My characters are actually impossible. I have a profile, and I have a front-facing one, like, and there's like these three-quarter angle like cheats that I have, but if you actually try to, and they actually don't work. They're designed for the flat image.
Your characters certainly break the rules of human proportions in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Do you find that, I almost feel like that might free you up to draw them to do literally anything, because
yeah.
you're sort of reinventing the wheel.
Well,
you're drawing them in different angles.
Yeah, well, stylistically, I mean, the way I draw was more of a hindrance in the beginning of my career than anything else. Like, I literally had editors say, like, you know, because I can vary my style a lot. So I would have guys be like, oh, well, draw more like Scotty Young, or draw more like Ben Tipplesmith, or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was complete hindrance. It wasn't until Chew that I, like, people got it. And now it is incredibly free, because I can do whatever I want, because I've, again, created a world in a reality where, like, it's expected of me to be dynamic.
Yeah.
So it's I can't be stagnant, really. I mean, it's a really nice place to be, because stylistically, you know, as an artist, I am very young and I am still growing into it, and it I feel like I have room to grow. Like I can try different things every issue, and no one's gonna say, oh, what is he doing? Like,
right.
He's not drawing like he's supposed to draw.
Because you've set these parameters for yourself where
right, exactly. Where it's only expected of me
yeah.
that the next issue is gonna be a little better than this issue, hopefully.
Right.
So it's totally free. And I mean, it definitely works in a world where I am we have all these crazy characters, and I mean I was saying in the panel I just did, like in issue 41 we have a like I said, Chew is a world where there's just food related powers, which sounds ridiculous. And you will not get it unless you read it. But we've gone so far into it. I mean, we're 40 issues into it, and we've gotten to a place now where in issue 41, there's a guy, an FDA guy. FDA is like the Homeland Security of Chew. And there's a guy who's an FDA higher-up, he's like a lieutenant, and he has a bodyguard. And his bodyguard is a gigantic gingerbread man. He's a gingerbread man, he's like in a suit, black suit, with like shades and a little earpiece. And we never acknowledge it, and we never say, he's just in the background. And we never explain it, and people will ask, like, what's up with that guy? And we're never going to explain it. And people are going to be okay with it. And we've done that already, because we've established a world where, like, we're just going to do whatever we want.
Well, there's an issue where one of the FDA agents is a lion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
a lion walker. Like.
Well, there's different, like, we've kind of established different, like, for every agency has a thing. Like, the FDA, they're just, you know, weird food gas. The USDA is all really, really over the top, like, stereotypical. Like, we make fun of the comic stereotype of women of being overly busty and, like, tight clothes. They're like, we make fun of it completely. It's so dramatically over the top. It's ridiculous. But they have sidekicks, and their sidekicks are cybernetic animals. So yeah, we have Buttercup. Buttercup's the cybernetic lion. It's way out there.
It's great.
It's fun.
And then speaking of way out there, and dynamic, and ridiculous, Eric.
What?
The Savage Dragon is all of those things.
It is.
And clearly you created, I mean, this is your baby. This is a thing that you've been doing since you were a child.
A small boy, yeah. I started it when I was in, like, fourth grade.
So you are really taking, you know, I've heard the phrase kid logic used before to explain certain comic book things, and you've really extrapolated that your entire career, but especially with Dragon. You really do push things in your layouts, in your character posing, your character proportions, yet... Interestingly enough, your comic is working in real time.
Yes.
And
well, I wanted to do that. Well, that's one of those things that people always talk about with like Marvel and DC Comics, is they always go, Well, wouldn't it be cool if Spider-Man would get old? Because eventually you get to that point where you're older than Spider-Man. And it's like, what happened? I was younger than Spider-Man. He was in college, and now I'm out of college. And how come he doesn't get older like me? And so I wanted to go, well, let's try that and see how that works. The thing is that Marvel and DC couldn't really do that because they would just wreck all of their toys. They would just, everything that they had, they would just be breaking. And then they couldn't use them anymore. Whereas on my own, it's like, I can make up more toys. I can just keep this going and be making up new villains and new crazy situations forever. And it's been fun to just be able to play with it. There are definitely problems with setting things in real time. Because if you're like planning if you're a villain and you're scheming for any length of time, suddenly you go, wait a minute, he's been standing in that room with his hands behind his back for 4 months. Get your act together, mister.
So I guess that would be an example of a reality kind of getting in the way.
Yes.
Of imagination and.
Yeah, there are. So there'll be like clumps of issues where it will be, okay, these are take place over a weekend. Now I've got to cover a lot of time in other issues.
Yeah.
Can I add something? I'm sorry.
I already told you.
In addition to, you know, what we're all talking about in terms of, you know, conceptual things, I just wanted to say that people who draw realistically, and we know who they are
and where they live,
bore me. You know, I find that to be ultimately incredibly boring and uninteresting. And I think that's one of the big drawbacks to drawing in a photorealistic style, is that it is boring. The figures are stiff. You're limited only. You're limited entirely to your reference, and you can't go beyond your reference. And oftentimes your reference is completely inadequate. You're not pulling, things out of your imagination. I just find that work to be incredibly shallow, empty, boring.
I don't disagree, and that's going to segue us a bit into...
I'll knock it off.
Eric, you do not fall into that category.
No, I know. I never referenced anything about it.
Well, I want to talk a little bit and segue that into stories, because stories can also become very boring if they get overly realistic, right. Especially in a genre like superheroes or science fiction, where you start to dwell on the minutiae of, say, I don't know, Superman fixing a toilet. Come on, I had to take the shot.
That would be good.
That would be good if he had super toilet breath. But I want to talk about stories and the kinds of stories you guys are involved in. Rob, I know you don't write Chew, but you're involved in the process. And you know, you mentioned before we came in the room that before you were doing Chew, you were writing and drawing your own stories. And we are all cartoonists. And I think something that defines a cartoonist is writing with pictures, telling stories with pictures and words in combination. So, Kazu, you already talked about your stories having that emotional grounding, that emotional realism to sort of carry you through the more imaginative parts.
Think all of the characters have to be part of that world and believe in that world. I think that's an important aspect to all this stuff.
Yeah.
If any of the characters are suddenly looking at their own hands and going, what the hell? My fingers are so square. What the hell? That's just really screwed up.
Well, in our books, actually, we do, if we're talking about style, we do make sure that we light everything realistically. So we have a lot of cartoons like living in this scene, and Jason and I will reference cinematographers all the time. You know, we'll just be like, oh, that's like shot just like the way Wally Pfister would shoot that, you know. Hey, take a look, go look at Nicholas Ray's old films. I think I want this scene to feel a little creepy, so I want it to, let's shoot it like a 70s Nick Ray film, you know. But we would have cartoons in those. And so it goes back to the idea of believability.
Sure.
Because I think people look at those, the way something is shot, like, you know, like the new Batman movies, and go, look at the cinematography. It's like, so that's a Wally Pfister shot movie. Like, that looks, like, even though it's not realistic at all, because if you're on a movie set, there's so much light and there's there's so much technical stuff going on that if you actually saw it in real life, it would look completely unreal to you. But for us, the language of cinema, realism has its own kind of dialogue, and we try to use that to get people to associate our stories as being shot like it was really happening, and we use that cinematic language, the visual language, as a way to make it relatable in that way.
Sure. And then by comparison, in comic book language, Klaus, you might be able to speak to this, and Eric certainly. You know, I've seen comics that you have colored, Klaus, where you'll just use like a solid magenta to light a scene, and the highlights are magenta against natural colors or what have you. And Eric, you've done similar things where you limit your palette on purpose to evoke a certain spirit.
Oh, yeah.
What are you trying to do when you do that? What is the goal when you
Eric?
Approach color in a much more abstract manner? An unrealistic manner, if you will.
No, but I like it. I like to see effect of it, you know? I like sometimes for a comic book to feel like a comic book and look like a comic book, and I'll drag in, like, newsprint, so there's big chunks of wood floating around on there, and everything's out of register. I like old comics where they used to knock things out, which is just like taking, I got this whole figure of the Hulk in his pants and everything, and I'm just going to color him orange. Just a big flat orange shape, and then the background is going to be blue. We're good. That panel's done. Moving on.
But there's also some storytelling.
Yeah, well, there can be. Or there can be just, I'm just screwing around.
Klaus, do you want to talk about the storytelling aspects of doing that?
One of the things that I really loved doing when I was doing Daredevil was coloring the books, or at least the last year, a year and a half of our run on it. And that's the kind of thing that you're talking about. And I remember, somebody today brought up a Punisher cover that had him, one of my favorite covers that I did on that book, it had him in the water, and there was Zippertone, black Zippertone in the background, and the entire cover was yellow. I mean, just all of it was yellow. I don't know if they would let us do something like that, you know, today. And the idea of it was just that it was, you know, visually catching. It had a feel of electricity to it because he was firing a gun. There was some movement to it. And I think if we had colored it, realistically, you know, the problem with photorealism and or color realism is that everything looks the same.
Yeah.
And if we were all doing photorealism, we'd all be doing work that looked the same. And how boring would that be?
Well, also, I mean, you just look around the room right now. Everything is in high def, and everything is fully rendered. When you're doing a comic book, you don't necessarily want somebody to be focusing on a fork next to a plate in the background. That's not your primary concern. So if you can go, I'm just taking this entire background and coloring the whole thing light blue, and I'm just going to focus on these two guys that are having this intense conversation and just color the shit out of those guys, then you'll be like, I'm actually focusing on the stuff that's important in this panel instead of being distracted by the minutiae of this other stuff, which may not be important.
Well, and I think, one of the important things that Eric is talking about is the ability for an artist or a storyteller to see his vision through. And that doesn't happen that often anymore in comics today. There aren't that many people who can pencil, ink, and color a book. Eric being the exception, that's what I'm saying. But the ability to fulfill your own vision and it is much more rare these days than it used to be, I think, 20 years ago. The coloring technique is so complicated and so time-consuming that no one could do it on a monthly basis and pencil and ink the book also. We lose a little, we gain a little, but I think that, you know, we need to be, as consumers, need to be aware of what we are looking at and how we are consuming it, and, you know, the gains and losses that we've made in the last 20 years in this business.
But I would say there actually is a generation of artists that can do all those things really, really well. But a lot of them don't work in comics. It's because they're getting paid very well in animation and video games. And they just are going where the jobs are. That's really what's happened in the last 10, 20 years. You know, it was like an implosion in comics. I mean, you guys remember what happened, and I think it's had a lasting effect. And to Eric's credit, I will say he's been doing so much to try to bring it back. I actually feel like Image has been, like, even though like a lot of people look like will blame Image because of for some of it, but I feel like what Image has been doing for the last, you know, decade or so is actually bringing comics back into the mainstream, like a true mainstream. And it's a lot of those young artists, though, I know those artists, and I talk to them all the time. They are just going to animation studios right now, and there's like a saturation of talent out there. There's too many there now.
And what's interesting about the people that are in animation, they love making comics, and when they have time off, they make comics, and they're making comics that really use the tools of comics. So they're using certain dynamic panel compositions, sound effects, thought balloons, which is a thing that have really fallen off.
A weird thing is that DC some time ago did a book called Bizarro Comics. And it was just underground cartoonists and just guys not from the complete mainstream doing their superhero, Marvel, DC superheroes. And that particular book had more love and affection for those characters than anything from their regular monthly comic.
And it's a real attachment to, again, those tools, right? Like, doing things that comics do, whether it's knocking out backgrounds in light purple or having a character with a thought balloon where you are reading their thoughts, and it's not a narrative box in a corner, but it is a direct line into that character's brain, something you really can't do anywhere else in a way that you can buy. If you do it in a TV show where there's a voiceover, it feels like a cheat.
Well, I think that we have lost a lot in the last couple generations is just that all of the things that we can do that they can't do in these other things. And now we're sitting there trying to emulate the things that they are doing rather than do these things that we can do way better than them. Like, they can't really pull off Mr. Miracle's costume in a real movie where he basically is pulling cloth over his face and it's adhering to everything, where it's just his eyes are showing through, and it's like, you can't make material do that. It doesn't function that way in the real world. And instead of comics doing what they can't do and them being trying to catch up with us, we're instead going, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you could see how Wolverine's costume is stitched together? That'd be really awesome if there was a seam going right in the middle of his forehead, and then we could see how those gloves are put together, because I think that's the interesting thing, is how they attach the thumb, because that's really cool.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Eric.
That's fine.
But you know, you're exciting me.
You guys know what I'm saying?
I remember going a couple of years ago to a exhibit by Alex Ross in New York, and so I've said, you know, Alex Ross. So I'm walking around, I'm with a friend, and I'm shaking my head, and I'm just thinking, I don't get this. I don't get what all the excitement is. And my friend said something that I'll never forget, which was very, very astute. He turned to me and he said, it's all about the fact that that Alex is putting wrinkles in the in the costumes. And in that moment, I got it. I got exactly what Alex Ross is doing, and that's exactly what Eric is talking about. And that stuff bores the crap out of me. It just, I'm not interested
in putting... Will put wrinkles in clothes, they look amazing.
Well, that's because it was a fedora and a trench coat.
He used the wrinkles to evoke movement in a static medium. Again, a tool that comics can do that...
You've got Captain America's costume, which is made out of little metal fish scales, and it turns into cloth magically as it enters his neck and attaches to his head. And his ears stick out and they don't look retarded. And he's got little wings on, and it's like, that costume doesn't work in a real world. And I think we, as people working in this industry, should be doing more of that. Just going, yeah, catch up with this. Do this. See if you can make this work, guys.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I'm reminded of an interview with Frank Miller. I think it was in the Miller-Eisner book. But he's talking about like how he had a swing back. Like he had a period where he was getting more into doing realistic stuff. And at some point, he realized, like, that he wanted to see, like, the sweat flying off of people's foreheads. And, like, he wanted to see the ridiculous stuff that only comics can do.
Yeah.
There's something to, like, the celebration of what comics is.
I like characters who stand with their feet, like, 7 feet apart. There's no possible way that they can...
Right, and I mean, I think there's
something... They're so cool.
Right, I mean, I think it's cool. Like we were saying about, like, Brian Hitch, like, he does great work, but... There are certain comic artists that try to be more cinematic, which is fine, but I think comics has a strength to just be comics. We're not movies, we're just comics.
And I think it's an important thing to say. I think it's fine if people do realistic things. I just think that there's so much room to do so much more that it shouldn't be, let's just do this.
Well,
you
mean,
know? And I think that was the problem with, I mean, the sons and daughters of Watchmen. You know,
that's
the gaps,
Alex
Ross's and the everything else, yeah, which is too realistic.
So play devil's advocate, guys. This is a fun panel.
Yeah.
But I came from the film industry, and I actually, you know, was working in animation before I went into comics. And I actually never felt a problem, a limitation with a lot of the media. In any form, like whether I was a graphic designer, I was a graphic designer in architecture for a while. Before going into film, and I was working in animation and live action, and I thought the media was always great. Like, all, you know, anywhere I went, you could do something. That's what being a creative is. You're supposed to work with nothing and turn it into something. So I never really thought like the media was limiting. And when I went into comics, I didn't feel that at all either. I actually loved comics because I just liked the community. And I was comfortable drawing comics because I felt like I could assume more of the risk of the project, the entire project. So that it allowed me to take more risks in the storytelling. I just never felt that comics necessarily did anything better than a lot of other things. My thing is the media. I'm not like kind of a media is the message guy.
Right.
I just feel like creators, like a lot of us, we just have to work within the framework of what we're given. I think comic artists are given a good set of tools though that aren't being maximized because I think a lot of people look at the business side of it too quickly and think, oh, I can't make a living being a comic book artist, when it's absolutely not true.
And I think a nice example might be, and I think this will really tie things together, one of the most realistic comics I've ever read is Mouse, which is autobiographical, it's emotional, it's heart-wrenching, and...
That's a great example.
That is a great
characters
example.
Characters
yeah.
are animals telling a human story, and that's Art Spiegelman using every tool that comics are capable of. Art styles changing, iconography, all these things, and... You know, that's for me a high watermark of comics, where somebody has taken a very personal, real story and told it in a comic book way. And I think
right, because yeah, there's an established like there's something established there where you know what he's talking about.
Yeah,
it's like we're in on the secret, so we know that these aren't mice.
Well, again, it's that emotional grounding,
right.
that you know, the human emotional connection that you make by telling a story, but in telling it in a way that is distinct and specific to comics. As a medium that can do things not better or worse, but different than film or a novel or a song. And I think all of you guys do that with comics. I think you do it all effectively. And I thank you for joining me and having this conversation.
Thanks,
well, thanks for having us. Uh-huh.
Anybody want to plug anything? Go, start from the end.
I'll give Eric an image a plug. I think that, you know, on the topic that what we're talking about is the opportunity that Image has given the industry to do comics that are personally driven rather than corporate driven. And I think that that's an amazingly beneficial thing for this industry to have a place like Image. And I think Eric and the rest of the guys at Image deserve a lot of credit for that. You're not going to see a lot of creativity from the corporate people in this industry. You're going to see a lot of newer things and a lot of more personal. The best work is always personal without corporate interference. And I think that's what Image is allowing a lot of people to do. And I think you guys deserve a lot of credit.
Wow. Jeez. I didn't even ask for that. That's pretty good.
Hazard?
Well, I guess going back onto the previous idea, just about cartoons, I feel like, you know, one of the things that comics does do well is that you're able to create symbols. I feel like going back over the history of comics, I feel like thinking about Mouse, you see these moving symbols, and the idea of these symbols, like going through these emotions, like a superhero, like the superhero, the Superman emblem is itself a character in my mind, you know, and it's just these symbols that move around. I think there's a power in that sometimes, you know, gets lost, and maybe that's what we were discussing about, you know, the realism aspect of it, that things become less like symbols. But anyway, as far as plugging things, I just finished Amulet 6. It's the sixth book in the Amulet series. It'll be out in the fall.
Is there an end?
Is there?
How many?
I'm going into the last book in the contract, with the idea that it would be the last one. But I thought the second one was going to be the last one when I started that one. But right now I told them I was going to go seven books, and that's what my contract is for. And I'm not sure if it's going to land right there. But because I have a lot of kids coming up to me and asking to extend it, and I don't know. I had a nice conversation with Stan Sakai just now about that idea, you know, because he obviously went, and you too. You're a great person to talk about that. So
just keep it going.
I don't know. I'm not gonna say it in public, I guess, but I have had discussions with my editor about where we're gonna go. So pretty soon. There's an end.
All right.
Yeah, there is an end.
There is no end for Savage Dragon. It's going to go on until I die, and that'll be the last issue.
You are the Savage Dragon.
That's it.
Mike,
Rob?
Just chew.
Chew your food 100 times before you swallow it.
Chew. I'm 41 issues into it. I pencil ink and color it, so I can do about 9 issues a year-ish. I only have about 20 issues left, so that's going to be another couple years. I'm kind of planning some other things, some personal projects and that kind of thing. I'm still kind of finding my voice and getting comfortable with it, so we'll see, but yeah, that's it for now.
All right, and if you're interested, pick up SpongeBob comics, but more importantly, if you like this conversation and like the way I talk to these folks, check out my podcast, Stuff Said, at StuffSaidShow.com. We have conversations like this. I talk one-on-one with comic book people, artists, writers, retailers, convention organizers. The man who organized this convention, Jim DiMonacos, did a two-parter with me, and that's a great conversation. So thank you all, and thank you all for coming, and I hope you know that this was the best panel of the convention.
'Have kept that conversation going for much longer. I hope you enjoyed it. I gotta say, it's weird to hear myself plugging the show while it's in the show. It's not like you who are listening right now don't know about it. You're listening to it. The plug is useless after the fact, so I'm sorry you had to listen to that, I guess. Hopefully you enjoyed it, though. Despite the sort of audio echo stuff. But speaking of plugs, these are less useless because they're in the moment right now. The website for this show is StuffSaidShow.com. If you go there, there is bonus content, artwork, links. You can leave comments about the show. Just recently, a comment was posted by Dan Panosian in response to the Paul Azaceta episode. A fun comment went up about the Rex Lee episode. I respond to these things. At the website, you can also donate to the show. I mentioned this at the beginning. You might be asking, how much do you want us to donate? You know what? That's completely up to you. I've heard of shows saying $1 an episode. You can break it down if you want. 5 cents a minute. $0 and 0 cents. I'm still hoping for that $3 million donation, of course. That would be great. And like I said, I promised if I have $3 million, I'll put out more than one episode a month. But if you donate, that money will go towards the show. New equipment is on the horizon, for one thing. And that would be great to have that supported. So thank you in advance. I am on Twitter, at Greg Schiegel, GREGGSCHIGIEL. You can email the show at stuffsaid@gmail.com. The show is on iTunes. I encourage you to go there, give it 5 stars, and leave a comment. If you don't know what to write, write either the words 5 stars, F-I-V-E space S-T-A-R-S, or you can write whatever you want, or taking a note from Eric Larson in this very show you just listened to, you can call it a spicy cocktail. Just write a spicy cocktail. The show is part of the Acme Wave Projector Network as well. You can listen to that and all of their shows at acmewaveprojector.com. Again, you can read the first chapter of my book, Picks One Weirdest Weekend, at pixcomic.com, pixcomic.com. I will be promoting this book forever. So get on board, gang. Get on board. The theme song for the show is by Craig Chin. You can find him at rudeanagrams.com. More about me is at hatterentertainment.com, H-A-T-T-E-R, entertainment.com. The next episode takes us back to the traditional one-on-one format. The panels are over for now. Until then, that's about all the stuff I have left to say. See you next time.